Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Historian Leslie Berlin is a Tulsa native that has documented the founders of the Information Age. As the project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University, she's helped collect and disseminate the story of the beginnings of our latest era of American business. She's the author of The Man Behind the Microchip, her biography of microchip co-inventor and Intel co-founder Robert Noyce, and her book released last year, Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age, told the story of a handful of tech innovators and entrepreneurs in the 60s and 70s, legends within Silicon Valley, but little known outside of it. People like Bob Taylor, who kick-started ARPANET and masterminded the PC, the third wheel at Apple, the first chairman, Mike Markala, Al Alcorn, the Atari engineer behind the first successful video game, or Bob Swanson, the co-founder of Genentech. Women played a substantial role as well. Sandra Kurtzig, a software entrepreneur and first woman to take a technology company public, or Fawn Alvarez, who went from being an assembler on a factory floor in the Valley to becoming a top executive. I spoke with Leslie Berlin about Troublemakers late last year when the book first came out. It's now newly out in softcover. You have this new book out, which is really detailing a period of time in which this ought to be in every history book. This era of about 1969 to 1976, you refer to it as the most significant side of technological innovation in 150 years. And while we know Silicon Valley is important to our high-tech economy, we really don't know the individual things that went on during this particular time. What happened during this particular point in time?
I really think of it as something like the Big Bang or the Beatles sometimes is the analogy I come up with, which is that 1963, Beatles are doing covers of Little Richard songs. And by 1970, they've completely transformed music and culture and so much around them. And if you look at this same period of time in Silicon Valley, before that, Silicon Valley was all about microchips. But after a period of just this little window of time, you have the birth of the personal computer industry, the video game industry, the modern venture capital industry, the biotech industry. You have advanced semiconductor logic, which really sort of lies at the heart of AI today and the internet, of course. You also have the first internet transmission coming into this place. So it's just this incredible explosion of activity. And this is the time that Silicon Valley really gets on the map as well. This is when you really see people in the Valley making an effort to go to Washington, D.C. and say, our industry is important. And this really brings high tech to the center of American consciousness and the starting of bringing it into where it is today in our lives, which is such an intimate relationship we have with our technology. I mean, think about when you lose your cell phone. What, you know, the sort of panic that ensues because these little devices, they know who we know. They know how to reach them. I mean, who remembers a phone number anymore? You know, they know where we've gone. They know what we're doing. It's incredible.
They serve as maps.
Yeah.
They serve as, you know,
books.
Yeah, yeah. You're linked to your bank, to everything else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and all of that is starting on this narrow strip of peninsula in this just compressed window of time. And so then for me, the challenge became, how do I tell this story? Because, I mean, these are the birth of huge companies, right? This is Apple. This is Intel's a year old. Genentech is born. Atari is born. The big venture capital firms like Sequoia Capital are born. And so how do you tell this story of all these industries, all these companies? And I decided the secret was I had to find people, because that's what we care about, is sort of the narrative and who are the people involved. And I wanted it to be people who were three things. They had to have done something important or tell us something important about the Valley. They had to be relatively unknown, because I think that there's this terrible misconception about innovation, which is sort of the lone genius in a lab or a garage or something like that.
The Thomas Edison, the Alexander Graham Bell, those sorts of folks.
Exactly. And when, in fact, innovation is a team sport, it's like a pitcher who's thrown a perfect game, where anyone who was watching the game knows that the first baseman just killed himself to step on the base. And, you know, you've got these insane fly balls being caught in the outfield. And the catcher has made the perfect call, calibrated to each batter. But the only thing that goes down in history is that the pitcher threw a perfect game. So that was the second criteria for these people, was I wanted them to be unknown as well. So important and unknown. And then the third thing was that they had to be interesting. They had to be super interesting people. And Silicon Valley's full of characters. So that last criteria was easy to fulfill.
But, you know, getting back to that second point, the idea that, you know, this industry was built by teams of people, not by individuals. Even as much as we talk about Steve Jobs and Apple, it was teams of people that built Apple. It was not necessarily, I mean, Steve Jobs couldn't have done it by himself. And I think that makes the story a little bit more difficult to tell, because it's more interesting to hear about, you know, Alexander Graham Bell trying to come up with this communication tool that would eventually be a telephone and working in the laboratory and the assistants in the other room. But in this case, you always have these teams of people developing all this.
Right. I mean, so the Apple story, so I write about the birth of Apple.
Right, you do.
And they're the two Steves in the garage in 1976. But something that I know, since I spent my entire career studying this, is that all over, not just Silicon Valley, but like in Albuquerque, in Boston, there were these little startups in the equivalent of garages with a really smart tech guy, probably not as smart as Steve Wozniak, a really smart business guy, probably not as smart as Steve Jobs, who they were all trying to start little companies. And so why did Apple make it? And I look at someone who basically no one's ever looked at, a guy whose name is Mike Markla. Well, Mike owned a third of Apple. It was Jobs, Wozniak, and Markla. And Mike was a guy who had retired from Intel at the ripe old age of 34. And he had gone to the garage because he had gotten tired of not being around really high-energy young people anymore. And so he had set up a little one-day-a-week consulting business, heard about these two guys from another friend, and went to talk to them, and kind of dragged himself kicking and screaming into chairing Apple and really bringing that company into, it was the youngest company ever to hit the Fortune 500. And if you think about it, of course Steve Jobs couldn't have done that. Steve Jobs was 21 years old. He had 17 months business experience total in his entire life. And that was as a technician working for Atari. And so it takes nothing away from Jobs or what he became later or what he was then to say that he realized he needed help. And he turned to someone who had done it before, someone who had been in the industry that had come up the generation before, for help in figuring out how to get it done. And to me, that doesn't take away from the stories of these individual great men. Because, I mean, Steve Jobs is the first person to talk about. He gave this incredible commencement address at Stanford in 2005 that really anyone listening, it is worth taking the 10 minutes to listen to this. And he talks about all sorts of things, his failures, his successes, his fears with his cancer diagnosis. And one of the things he talks about is when he was fired from Apple in 1985. And he says that the first thing he did was turn around and call David Packard and Robert Noyce, who were two leading entrepreneurs from the previous generations. Noyce is the subject of my first book. And Jobs called them to apologize for what he called dropping the baton. He pictured like a relay race from one generation to the next, handing off the baton. And that, I think, is one of the unrecognized secrets, not just of Silicon Valley, but I would say a lot of business success around this country and around the world, is that the smart people know, wait a second, there are people who've done this before, and I can lean on their expertise.
One of the first stories you tell in the book is the story of Bob Taylor. And of course, you keep coming back to these stories. And the last thing he says in the book, I think, has something about, you know, it's important, since we talk about individuals a lot in this industry, he said, but it's more important that I think the smartest person in the room, I'm paraphrasing, but the smartest person in the room is not one person, it's all of us.
Right. Wait, none of us is as smart as all of us. That's right. What he says.
Yeah.
It's funny because, of course, I'm talking about individuals while at the same time I'm trying to show the importance of people working together. And Bob Taylor is one of these unknown. I mean, Bob Taylor is the person who convinced the Department of Defense to start the ARPANET that eventually morphed into the internet. And then he went on to run the lab at Xerox PARC that developed basically everything that we think of today in terms of the personal computer. And really, our phones are just shrunken down personal computers in a lot of ways. So by 1973, in Bob Taylor's lab, they had networked computers with graphical user interfaces and windows and a mouse to control things. They were networked to each other. They were sending emails to each other. I mean, this is at least, it's really 20 years before this stuff starts to really make its way out. And then, by the way, the third thing he did was start a different lab that, among other things, developed electronic books. And one of his researchers was key in the birth of the first real search engine 4 years before Google. So Taylor is one of the, but you know, Taylor had a master's degree in psychology. He wasn't a computer scientist.
Right.
He literally had computer scientists of PhDs, of course, all of them, of such high caliber that the president of MIT worried about the state of computer science in universities around the country because all of the best researchers had gone to Palo Alto to work for Bob Taylor at Xerox PARC.
Who was a psychologist,
right? Someone described him as a concert pianist without fingers. He could hear the music. He knew what he wanted it to sound like. He had no idea how to play it. And what he was able to do was find these people and work, help them work together to build this thing that he was imagining that they also had very much bought into.
And one of your first stories gives you a sense of how he cuts through red tape, and he was not fond of any sort of red tape. And his first story about how he pitched ARPANET to the Pentagon is pretty amazing.
Oh, man. He hated bureaucracy. He always wanted to play professional football, but he was a little too small. But he basically treated any sort of bureaucratic encounter as something to just kind of put your shoulder down and, you know, barrel through. Yeah, so the Pentagon, there was no place that was more sort of stratified and bureaucratic. And there were all, first of all, one of the things I thought was incredible, this is the beauty of historical research, is to discover that people at the Pentagon, the way the mail was delivered was these men on these giant grown-up sized tricycles with a basket in the back who would like pedal through the halls delivering the mail. And there were these elaborate protocols you had to follow to talk to, say, your boss. Your secretary had to call his secretary, and there was all of this around who had to call whom and whose secretary had to call whom. And Taylor just literally barged into people's offices and just started talking and spinning an image of what could happen that was so persuasive that people who had been enraged would, you know, sit down and start to listen. I mean, one thing that I want to point out that is that there's always been this story that the internet was started to make sure that there were communications in the event of nuclear war. And I just, if I can do one thing, I'd like to dispel that. That's just not true. They were trying to save money to some extent because there are all these different computer systems that couldn't talk to each other. But also, Taylor really had a vision that creativity and the world as we know it and progress would be better if people could find like-minded people in other places and communicate with them.
Yeah, and that's certainly what the internet has done.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Another person, when we think of Silicon Valley today, we think of it a male-dominated society, and a lot of women, when they do rise up, they do have a lot of sexism issues that are involved. You do chronicle two women of the seven troublemakers, as you refer to them. Sandra Kurtzik is really interesting. She's the first woman to take a technology company public and really used the fact that women were rarity in the corporate world as well as Silicon Valley as a benefit. It got her into doors that she might not otherwise gotten into.
Yeah, she took a really interesting approach. I mean, what I wanted to write about Sandy, it was nice that she's a woman. She was also a software entrepreneur, and this was at a time she started a company called Ask, and they built manufacturing software. And this was at a time when Silicon Valley was all about hardware. It was all about chips and computers and
about
phone
using
systems.
A mainframe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They were sort of moving from mainframes to mini computers. And so software was so underappreciated that even Larry Ellison, who everyone knows now is, you know, the founder, co-founder actually, of Oracle and very important man in running the whole place, he describes going to raise venture capital and being laughed out of people's offices. And what he was doing sounded so shady, this whole notion of software. What the heck? You can't touch it. You can't see it. You know, the secretaries would look in his bag to make sure that he hadn't stolen a copy of Business Week on his way out. And so here you have Sandy Kurtzig, and she is already an outsider because she's in software. But then on top of that, she's a woman. So when she told people she was selling software, they thought she was selling lingerie. And she, you know, what makes Sandy's story incredible is that Silicon Valley, that sort of baton pass that I was talking about, and the networks that are so important in Silicon Valley, Sandy did what she did completely outside of the established networks. She didn't think of herself as running a tech company. She thought of herself as a small businesswoman. And consequently, she bootstrapped the whole thing and ended up with 87% of her company, which she still owned when that company went public. And, you know, it made her very wealthy, of course. But she has always said that the fact that she was the boss really helped. And also, I mean,
and she had that rare combination of sales and the engineering background.
Right.
I mean, she could build the software, but she also could sell it.
That's exactly right. And she pretty quickly moved away from doing the actual coding, though. I mean, she was super smart. I think she graduated college at 20, and she was, I think, one of something like seven. I don't remember the exact number, but something like seven women graduating with a master's degree in the whole engineering school the year that she, there were 800 people listed in the program, and there were seven women. She was one of them. So she definitely had the chops. But Sandy really felt like she couldn't pretend that she wasn't a woman. And in fact, that she was very attractive. She's a very beautiful woman. And that was something that she just sort of acknowledged was part of her life. And in the same way that any good salesman wants to play up what sort of makes them memorable, she carried a briefcase that was pink, and she had her business cards printed in lavender. She always dressed, you know, she wore her hair long. She dressed as a woman, you know. And I mean, this was at a time, it wasn't until 1980 that sexual harassment was recognized as illegal. And this was a time when the best-selling advice book for a career woman, they suggested that the way to handle a pass was to say, oh, I'm so flattered, but, you know, not today. And so she really, the things that she was pushing against were significant, but they were just part of the air around her. And so with Fawn Alvarez, who's another person I talk about, Fawn, she worked in manufacturing, which is something that nobody knows about Silicon Valley now, which is that there used to be factories in Silicon Valley.
That's what Silicon Valley was. It was a manufacturing center before it became a high-tech center.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it went from a bunch of orchards of fruits to a place with all these factories.
Like
all
Lockheed and places like that.
Absolutely. Right? Mm-hmm. And even Intel, Apple built their own computers. I mean, everyone built them. They were local. And there was a real, these were really good middle class jobs that people without college educations could do. Many of them were at companies where the benefits were, you know, like Fawn worked at a company called Rome, where everyone from the president through the women on the manufacturing line, because they were all women, almost all women, they were all entitled to 3 months, I think, 3 months of paid vacation full time after 6 years of work, just like all at once. It was a sabbatical like that was given to everybody. Women on the manufacturing line could buy stock at the same discount as everyone else. So there were these middle class jobs that aren't there anymore. I mean, Silicon Valley, more than I think a lot of places on the planet at this point, you really see that has been completely hollowed out. So you have, you know, 1,000 square foot houses that are selling for $1.5 million. And that is what approximates a starter home. And right. So It's incredible.
Buffon was able to take that beginning working on the floor all the way up to the boardroom.
Yeah, she ended up as the chief of staff to the president of IBM Rome after IBM acquired Rome. And she did it through just sheer chutzpah and a very smart woman.
My guest today is Leslie Berlin. She's the project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and the author of Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you sort of mentioned just a moment ago was, as I was looking through a lot of these seven individuals, some of them had lots of education, formal education. Others did not have all that much education. We're talking some community college and then basically went right into business, or they were doing something in their garage at the same time they were going to college and realized that what they were learning in their garage was probably more valuable than what they were learning in the classroom. That was surprising to me because I think, you know, today we think of somebody having to have a master's in computer science and really having a lot of formal education to make these advances. But this was this one of these periods where a new industry far outstrips education's ability to teach what was happening. What was happening too fast.
Yeah, and it's funny. I was just on a panel with the head of engineering for Reddit, and he was saying that he thinks that we need to be doing more in that direction now. He said we should be hiring much more out of coding academies, for example, because the skills change that are needed change so quickly. And, you know, something that just occurred to me is it's funny because we're talking about Silicon Valley, of course. And, you know, part of what made Silicon Valley incredible was this and continues to is this finely developed ecosystem around entrepreneurs, specifically high tech entrepreneurs. But I would bet that a lot of people who have lived in Tulsa for a while, and particularly if they're familiar with the oil and gas industry, would see a lot of parallels where, I mean, in Silicon Valley, we always hear about the, you know, the entrepreneurs at the companies, right? But there was this whole universe of who are the equivalent of, you know, the pipeline suppliers who are also themselves entrepreneurs and a key part of this huge network. So in Silicon Valley, it was the places where you could get something prototyped or the community colleges that are giving exactly, you know, sort of the kind of education that people need or specialized law firms or specialized HR firms. And I think in Tulsa, in any sort of economy like that, it becomes like this finely tuned machine that is developed to kind of keep a certain type of business going, which I think is just super interesting.
Well, and you mentioned the entrepreneurs. That's also a big part of the oil industry as well as, I mean, it's anybody who can generate capital can go out and put out a lease and drill a hole.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's so often when people hear about Silicon Valley, especially in its current incarnation, it just seems sort of, you know, far away and Silicon Valley bears some responsibility for this kind of self-satisfied and highfalutin, you know, when people think about the Valley. But I think that what you see there, you see in all sorts of other places. You know, you go to the Twin Cities and they've got Minneapolis-St. Paul, and they have done the same thing around medical devices. And, you know, you go to the place Corning, New York, where the Gorilla Glass is made for the iPhones. Well, Corning has been a center of glass production since, you know, the 1800s. And so you see this again and again and again, and it's a very cool phenomenon.
Yeah. Now, not only do you tell the story of, like, computing and microprocessors and the beginning of the personal computers, but you also tell some other interesting stories. One is that of Niels Raymer, who, you know, you have these universities around the country that are these repository of brilliance and great ideas. And what for a long time, you know, either you stayed a member of the faculty or you went into business. And Raymer sort of created this hybrid where you could still be on the faculty and create these great ideas that would make not only the professor, but the university and everybody involved with the university a lot of money from a great idea and marketing it.
Yeah, I mean, Raymer's story is super duper interesting. I think that a theme of this book, actually, is that there used to be innovations locked up basically in the Pentagon or universities that during this time period I'm looking at, made their way out to the rest of us. And so Niels is one of the ways that that happens. He sets up an office to try to make it easier for Stanford faculty and staff and students to patent their ideas. And before he started this office, Stanford had made, from all of the intellectual property in the entire university, in the past 13 years, they had made $3,000 total. And he starts this office in 1970. After he starts this office, today Stanford has made $2 billion from the licenses and royalties. And that includes, for example, the search algorithm behind Google was developed at Stanford by two Stanford graduate students, the famous Sergey and Larry of Google, working actually under a federal contract. And Stanford got a piece of the rights to this search algorithm. They had a big stake in VMware, if people are familiar with that. The story that I tell is the first really controversial patent that Niels pursues, which is recombinant DNA, which led to the birth of the biotech industry. And now, you know, we think about the medications that we take and such, and of course we expect that some of them are going to have been synthesized using recombinant DNA techniques. But at the time, it was completely terrifying. I mean, there were protests. People were the mayor of Cambridge is saying that he's heard there's an orange-eyed monster, you know, outside of Harvard, and he thinks this might have to do with recombinant DNA experiments going on. So Niels's story is really interesting, A, because it's the birth of this major industry, but B, it completely changes how we get university ideas to the rest of the world. And he had to figure a lot of things out. And it, like, namely, the job of a university is to increase the storehouse of knowledge on this planet. And so how do you patent these ideas but not undermine the whole mission of a university, right? And so there were all sorts of exceptions that were made, and some of these were his innovations and some of them were federal law, where, you know, research institutions didn't have to pay and universities didn't have to pay. But yeah, it's a story that I wouldn't have guessed to be as interesting as it was. But Niels is another one of these people who's just a fighter.
When you talked earlier about Steve Jobs, about this handing of the baton, you said, you know, this generation is the second generation. The semiconductor generation was the first generation. And then this group of individuals and that was so tremendously successful was the second generation. But what I found interesting was this generation also constantly were reinventing themselves, and they would do something for a while and they would drop out and then they would find another idea that interested them. And, you know, they're still active into their 60s and 70s and still creating new interesting products through a couple of generations.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the people that I also write about is a guy named Al Alcorn.
Yes.
And Al is the developer of Pong, which is the first really huge video game, right? And he's at Atari. He's at Atari from the very, very beginning. And anyone who was alive in the 1980s knows how huge Atari was.
And if you're of a certain age, you know how big Pong was, because Pong was like mind-blowing.
And actually, there was just an article in the New York Times about the surprising resurgence of a retro Atari video game and how this, I think it's at the dollar stores, and how this has completely taken off because people feel a real nostalgia for it.
The name of the book is Troublemakers. Leslie, it's a pleasure to talk with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Leslie Berlin is the project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and the author of Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.